This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Major U.S. 401 Project Looks for Restart. And this article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left side, there's a picture of a man with a sport coat on, open-collared shirt. The caption reads, Steve Stroud Engineered Land Purchase. And then on the far right side of the article, there's a map showing the land, and we'll discuss the location in the article. And this article was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. Major new plans are surfacing for a $750 million real estate development project proposed for a tract of farmland at the intersection of Interstate 540 and Lewisburg Road. The 5401 North development plan has been on hold for the past 4 years, while its Baton Rouge owner has been sorting through road permit requirements and waiting for the housing market to begin picking up steam again. Commercial Properties Realty Trust of Baton Rouge has added 148 acres to the original 260-acre master plan approved in 2007 by the Raleigh City Council, which is requiring additional zoning changes and council approval again. The new plans won't change the density plan for the site, says Mac Paul, a lawyer with K&L Gates of Raleigh, who is representing the 5401 North project. In the 2006 master plan, Commercial Properties Realty Trust proposed building 1,200 residential units and about 1.2 million square feet of commercial space on 259 acres. The plan also set aside land for a 16-acre public park and 32 acres for the River Bend Elementary School. The new master plan, under review at the Raleigh Planning Department, incorporates the 800 residential lots that would be allowed under the zoning regulations for the 148-acre addition. It also sets aside a site for the construction of a public middle school. I don't anticipate we'll have any problems with approvals, Paul says. We've enjoyed tremendous support from the neighbors and have gotten unanimous approval on every level at the city. The 400 acres are bounded by Lewisburg Road and Interstate 540, as well as the Neuse River to the east and Wake Technical Community College's North Campus on the north side of the site. Since the plan's original approval, Commercial Properties Realty Trust has invested about $3 million to extend both Fox Road and Perry Creek Road to the site. The elementary school opened to students in January 2009. The 2010 master plan also shifts around the proposed land uses for houses, apartments, and commercial space to incorporate up to 2,000 residential units and up to 1.6 million square feet of commercial and retail space. Steve Stroud, chairman of NAI, Carroll Atlantic Realty in Raleigh, has been helping market the property to potential buyers. He says construction work at the site would have started sooner if permitting for the community's main entrance off Lewisburg Road had been approved earlier. Now she's cranking up the process, Stroud says, referring to Commercial Property Realty Trust chief executive Carolyn Martin. Martin was traveling and did not return calls for comment. The next round of infrastructure construction is slated to begin in the first quarter of 2011. We've recently picked up discussions again with interested clients, and it's just as strong as it ever was, Stroud says. This new plan will have a better flow and will be a better project. Project designer Victor Dover, a principal with the Dover Cole and Partners town planning firm of Coral Gables, Florida, says the new plan is much more refined than the earlier plans, and it better incorporates the streets, sidewalks, and greenways to create a more walkable, mixed-use community. Commercial Properties Realty Trust, which is an affiliate of the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, in 2007 paid almost $40 million for the 413 acres of land it purchased from Roebuck Properties and from the family of Robert and Vera Bradshaw. In our next article is also on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. It's in the center of the page, takes up most of the front page, has a black border around it. Inside that border at the top, there's a picture of two students standing outside of a building with their backpacks on, looking over a piece of paper. The caption reads, students from Vietnam, Van Nam, and Huyen Vu review some documents during orientation at UNC in Chapel Hill. And then under that picture, first on the left, there's the headline in bold black lettering. And then on the right side, the article starts. That headline, Gone Global Again, International Students Flooding Triangle Colleges with Applications. And this article is written by James Gallagher with a Dateline of Durham. International graduate applications and enrollment at area universities have surged this year, a sign that the Triangle remains among the world's top academic hubs. Duke University, NC State University, and UNC Chapel Hill each saw their applications from international graduate students increase by more than 11%, with enrollments expected to grow by similar amounts. Nationally, the increase in applications was 9%, according to the Council for Graduate Schools. And overall, applications finally ticked above 2003 levels, which was the last year before federal restrictions written in response to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks made it more difficult for international students to enter the U.S. From 2003 to 2004, international applications nationally fell by 28%, according to the council. The quality of the graduate education a student receives in the U.S. is still the best in the world, says Dwayne Larrick, dean of NCSU's graduate school, and the economies in Europe and Asia have improved to the point that they can come to the U.S. International applications at NCSU climbed from 7,146 in 2009 to 8,047 in 2010, though only 1,100 were offered admission, up by 100 from a year ago. About 620 new foreign graduate students are expected to enroll. Area universities have yet to tally official fall enrollments because some students who say they will attend never arrive on campus. Duke's international applications increased by 11.8% from 4,278 to 4,784, with 294 expected to enroll, up 13.9% from a year ago. And UNC saw its applications climb by 13.8% to 3,952. Despite the large increase in applications, Cheryl Thomas, Director of Graduate Admissions, says she expects to have about the same number of international students enroll. In 2009, UNC had 219 international graduate students. Graduate students generally consist of students working to earn a master's degree or PhD and exclude students working toward professional degrees such as law degrees, MBAs, and medical degrees. For the most part, the additional applications are coming from students in China, says Nathan Bell, Director of Research for the Council of Graduate Schools. The number of applications from China to U.S. institutions have been growing at a double-digit pace for the last half decade, he says. Thomas says that just about all the additional applications to UNC were from students in China, while the number of applications from students in India, number two nationally, actually declined. While the news provides cause to celebrate U.S. higher education's continued global appeal, the demand is expected to wane. Institutions in Europe and Asia are quickly expanding and improving the quality of their graduate education, taking a larger percentage of all graduate students worldwide, says Bell. And many of the international students being educated in the U.S. will return to their home countries and work at universities there. Larrick concedes that foreign students often put their degrees to use back in their home countries. While that's a negative, the positive is that the network of students further builds NCSU's global connections. There are several NCSU graduates teaching at universities across China and South Korea who still collaborate with professors in Raleigh. Now we have natural connections to collaborate with what is today and will be in the future some of the best universities in the world, Larrick says. And our next article we'll read is still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, and this one runs vertically along the bottom of the page. The headline, Want to Avoid a Wreck? In Raleigh, Steer Clear of Beltline Exits. And first, on the right side of the article, there's a picture of some of that traffic near a Beltline exit. The caption reads, Look for Interstate 440 intersections in North Raleigh to get even busier. And this article was written by Chris Basden with a Dateline of Raleigh. They are the intersections that no commuter wants to be near, the ones where traffic grinds to a halt, patience is exhausted, and someone gets too aggressive trying to beat a yellow light or merge into another lane. The result? A crash that slows traffic even more and in some cases causes injury or maybe even a death. There, the Triangle's high accident intersections, and the top of the list is dominated by a familiar name, the Beltline. Crash data from the North Carolina Department of Transportation show that from 2007 through 2009, the four triangle intersections with the highest number of collisions involved parts of I-440, the Beltline. The Beltline's intersection with Wake Forest Road topped the list with 300 crashes, followed by the 243 posted by I-440's meeting spot with Capitol Boulevard. The I-440 New Bern Avenue juncture tallied 206 crashes, while Six Forks Road's intersection with the Beltline notched 187. The top five was rounded out by the location where I-440 intersects South Saunders Street, 181. Being atop the list is often a reflection of the high volume of cars that travel through the intersections. A lot of the crashes are congestion-related, says Kelly Becker, a regional traffic engineer with NCDOT. The department uses its crash data to help determine where road improvements are made. Wake Forest Road is one such example. The department spent $3.6 million on an improvement project in 2008 and 2009 that added lanes, signals, and signs. They've certainly made the traffic flow a little faster through there, says Andy Anderson, an attorney who works in a building near the intersection. I think it's safer than it was before, though he adds that there's still room for improvement. NCDOT has two primary pots of money that it uses to fund safety-related improvements. The Spot Safety Program, which has $9 million in state money allocated to it annually, and the $30 million in federal funds that flow into the Highway Safety Improvement Program. That's a total of just $39 million for about 100,000 miles of roads. Could we do more with the money? Asked Kevin Lacey, the state traffic engineer at NCDOT. The answer is yes, he says. Finding more money in such a difficult economic environment as the current one is unlikely. NCDOT estimates that it would need more than $100 million per year in safety funds to meet its crash and fatality reduction goals. For instance, the department wants to have less than one fatal crash per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. Right now, that number sits at 1.3, though that's a decided improvement over the 1.65 it notched in 2004 and the 2.21 in 1990. The vast majority of crashes don't result in deaths, but one local intersection did gain notoriety in recent years for fatal crashes. The confluence of NC 57 and NC 157, or Guess Road in Orange County. At one point, that intersection, which is formed by two small, relatively narrow rural roads, was the site of five deaths in four fatal crashes in a period of just 18 months. Collisions in the area often were a result of people running the stop signs on NC 157 or of drivers misjudging the distance of oncoming vehicles. NCDOT considered a $700,000 project to install a traffic light and turn lanes at the intersection, but that is on hold for now. Instead, Lacey says, the department installed signs making the intersection a four-way stop in December, several weeks after the most recent fatal accident. Since then, there have been no deaths at the intersections, and he's not aware of any crashes there either. The four-way stop is working very well, says Lacey. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This one runs vertically along the far right side of the page. The headline, Health Reform to Flood EDs Even More, says study. And underneath the article, there's a picture of a bed in a hospital. And the caption reads, UNC Hospital's beds are often used by Medicaid patients. And this article was written by James Gallagher with a Dateline of Chapel Hill. Backlogged hospital emergency departments are not going to get any less crowded as a result of the passage of health care reform legislation, though hospitals should soon see their bottom lines improve. A surprising new study by a researcher at the University of California at San Francisco concludes that it is Medicaid patients who have been the main reason for clogged emergency departments, not the uninsured, which has been the conventional wisdom. Now, federal health care reform is about to result in the addition of 16 million people covered by Medicaid. If the UCSF research is on target, Medicaid recipients, the poor, children, and mothers, seek primary care at EDs rather than at private physician practices. The prospects are bittersweet for hospitals. On the one hand, they will be getting some payment, about 74 cents on the dollar under Medicaid in North Carolina, says Don Dalton, spokesman for the NC Hospital Association. But the hoped-for relief for emergency department crowding doesn't appear to be in the cards. In fact, the research points to even more crowded conditions in EDs. Medicaid patients are funneled into emergency departments for care because of the lack of other options, concludes the UCSF study, the results of which have been published by the Journal of the American Medical Association. Many health care providers reject Medicaid patients due to the low reimbursement rate. The study found that between 1997 and 2007, Medicaid patients increasingly turned to the ED for care. People on Medicaid visited an ED at double the rate of the uninsured and at five times the rate of those with private insurance, the study found. Emergency departments will become even more crowded than they are today, says Dr. Ning Tang, a physician at UCSF and the lead author of the study. In the Triangle, about 22% of emergency department patients are on Medicaid, according to figures compiled by the Hospital Association. Statewide, 24% of ED patients have Medicaid. Those percentages are much higher than the 13.8% of the state's population that is covered by Medicaid. The data comes from the Kaiser Family Foundation State Health Facts. The disproportionate use of the emergency department is due in large part to a dearth of primary care physicians, says Dr. Tim Carey, director of the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research at UNC Chapel Hill. Primary care physicians are best suited to help patients manage chronic diseases as well as treat minor acute health issues such as the flu or common cold. But because the state and nation lacks a sufficient number of primary care doctors, patients often have a hard time getting an appointment when acute illnesses pop up. And, says Brad Dean, a spokesman for the State Department of Health and Human Services, many Medicaid patients are unaware that they are better served by regularly seeing a primary care physician. North Carolina has been working to rectify the situation. Community Care of North Carolina is a state-affiliated, nonprofit organization that works to connect Medicaid patients with primary care physicians and put them in medical homes. The organization so far has signed up more than 1,400 physician practices and more than 1 million Medicaid patients, says Dean. The ultimate goal is to contain costs and improve quality of care. While hospital executives say they lose money on every Medicaid patient they treat, moving about half of the nation's uninsured onto Medicaid, as the federal health care reform bill does, ensures that hospitals will receive some reimbursement for their effort. Bernadette Spong, Rex Healthcare's chief financial officer, says that currently, if an uninsured person walks into the emergency room, chances are they are not going to have any type of ability to pay us. But with Medicaid, the hospital is going to get something. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, the headline that starts it off. Lady Wolfpackers get their due with nifty scoreboard. North Carolina State University's men's basketball team got a fancy new scoreboard last year when the Centennial Authority decided to upgrade the hardware at the RBC Center. Now the Lady Wolfpackers will get a chance to see their names up in some new lights. NCSU is shelling out $560,000 to Brookings, South Dakota-based Daktronics for a new digital scoreboard for venerable Reynolds Coliseum, where the women's basketball team plays. Coach Kelly Harper's eyes light up when she talks about how the scoreboard will allow for player introductions that are more fun and creative than in the past. While she's pleased with the addition of the scoreboard, Harper says that in the future, she'd also like to see some locker room renovations and a revamping of the building's lobby to showcase the sports history that's been made there. The idea, of course, is to make NCSU more attractive to top recruits. And what about the former Tennessee point guard's second season at the helm with the Wolfpack? Actually, I'm excited about the excitement, she says. There's just an air about the program that makes people want to be a part of it. People were decked out, limos were coming and going, and it looked like the patrons at the annual Jimmy V Gala were ready to part with some cash. Officials with the Jimmy V Foundation for Cancer Research said the charity raised more than $400,000 over the weekend from area companies, individuals, and sponsors of events. Celebrities from the reality TV show The Bachelorette were a hit with the crowd, as were the ESPN anchors. For locals, chatting it up with the Hurricanes players always is big fun. I like coming to this event, said Eric Cole, spotted hanging out with Joe Corvo. So Biz asked Corvo what he thought about this year's team. I think we will have a good team and it will keep getting better, he said. I think we finish fifth or sixth in the conference this year and then look out for us. That's a bold prediction by Corvo, who was picked up by Washington at the end of last season for the Caps Cup run before re-signing with the Canes. Fifth or sixth would be fine, as would seventh or eighth. Just get into the playoffs, and the Caniacs will push the team on to yet another cup. Six North Carolina communities, including Durham, Sanford, and Creedmoor in the Triangle, have been named among Kaboom Magazine's Playful City USA communities. The Playful City program honors communities that have gone above and beyond to provide children with active and healthy play options, such as neighborhood parks and walking trails. Regarding Sanford, Kaboom commended the city and Lee County Parks and Recreation for actively seeking to create more activity centers for children despite facing budget restrictions. It was the second year that Sanford and Durham were honored. It was the fourth year for Creedmoor. Other North Carolina towns on the list are Greensboro, Greenville, and Albemarle. Panera Bread, P.F. Chang's, and Chick-fil-A are among the top-ranked restaurant chains in the country, according to a new online survey of customers by restaurant reviewer Zagat. Among the large fast food chains, Panera was deemed to have the best facilities, and Chick-fil-A was noted for best service. Bonefish Grill won for both food and service in the full-service restaurant category, while P.F. Chang's China Bistro took the award for Best Facilities. In the individual fast service food categories, Starbucks won for Best Coffee, Five Guys won for Best Burgers, and Panera won for Best Salads. Among full service restaurants, IHOP was deemed to have the best coffee, Red Robin Gourmet Burgers had the best burgers, and the Cheesecake Factory had the best salads and desserts. Outback Steakhouse won for Best Steak, Cracker Barrel for Best Breakfast, P.F. Chang's for Best Appetizers, and Bonefish Grill for Best Seafood. Complete results can be found at www.zagat.com/fastfood. Officials at Raleigh-Durham International Airport are searching for a casual dining restaurant to add to their aviation station development near the airport. Sheetz has a gas station at the location, and a Burger King is in the process of being built. Airport Director John Brantley left little doubt in staff members' minds about what he'd like to see there. I told him my favorite was IHOP because I like pancakes, Brantley said at the authority's monthly meeting in August. Not a bad idea, John. Biz sure does love some Rudy Tooty Fresh and Fruity. Bring Clarence, boss. Oh, please bring Clarence. Don't be surprised if Bruce Springsteen is spotted among the Cameron crazies during Duke University basketball games this season. A tipster tells Biz that the legendary rock and roller was in the Triangle during the last full week of August and stayed at the Washington Duke Inn on a trip to help his daughter move in for her freshman year at Duke University. A Springsteen publicist did not respond to an email inquiry, and representatives of the hotel and the university wouldn't confirm the boss's presence. A Raleigh couple is making some noise in the fashion field. Jack Ray and Joelle Ray, owners of Raleigh's Samuel Cole Salon, traveled to Paris to participate in Giorgio Armani's Couture Armani Privé show on July 6. Celebrity stylist Oribe Canales, who has styled the hair of Jennifer Lopez and Lady Gaga, selected the pair to be part of his exclusive team of hairstylists for the fall collection show. It is one of the highest honors in our industry to be part of the Armani show, and we always enjoy working with Oribe, who is an industry icon, Joelle Ray says. We saw some amazing looks in Paris and look forward to incorporating them into our styles this fall. The high-energy couture show attracted guests that included celebrities, models, and fashion critics from around the globe. Among those mingling in the crowd were actresses Megan Fox and Cate Blanchett, just to name a couple. Behind the scenes, Biz is told the adrenaline was pumping as members of the stylist team, Jack and Joelle, helped create sensational hairstyles to balance Armani's fall line. Models were thick, long, blonde hair. Models with thick, long, blonde hair that looked natural and effortlessly beautiful strutted down the runway. Talk about inspiration. After being diagnosed with ovarian cancer just a few weeks ago, 21-year-old Ryan Andrews, daughter of Raleigh real estate developer Andy Andrews, is far from being down. From her hospital bed following surgery, Ryan decided to put a team together with her friend, Scotty Springer, for the Ovarian Cancer Awareness Walk on September 11 at Sanderson High School in Raleigh. More information at www.ovarianawareness.org. She's already signed on 91 people to walk or run on behalf of her group called Team Rhino. Her dad says Ryan's spirits are high and that she's determined to fight the disease and take her family and friends on an inspirational journey. Good luck, Ryan. Biz and all the team members are pulling for you. Magnolia Grill chef and cookbook author Karen Barker has teamed up with Breyer's Ice Cream to develop a locally inspired recipe called Sweet and Spicy Peach Pecan Sundae that she will dish up at the annual Kids Fest event in Raleigh on August 29. The recipe includes a blend of Breyer's peach ice cream, shortbread cookies, cinnamon, and other spices. Kids Fest is 1 to 5 p.m. at Triangle Town Center Mall in Raleigh. Few know the residential real estate business hereabouts and speaks more plainly about it than veteran broker Ed Willer of Prudential York Simpson Underwood. So when emails land in the biz box from Ed, they get opened pert quick. The news Willer wanted to share is just how far mortgage interest rates have fallen. Whoever thought we would see a mortgage interest rate with a 2 in front of it, Willer wrote in his mailing. Who indeed? But there it was. Granted, it's a 5-1 adjustable, but it's going for 2.625% through Home Services Lending, which Willer points out is owned by Warren Buffett, just like we are, he says. So dive in, folks, buy a house, and let's get this molasses economy moving again. Sparky gotten a little grungy over the hot summer? Then carry the fellow over to Whole Foods Market in Durham on Saturday, September 11 for the store's annual dog wash. For a suggested $15 donation or more, please, if Sparky's a big boy, volunteers will suds him up, rinse him off, and do a towel dry. For an additional donation of $8, Sparky will get a brushing, nail trim, a bandana, and yummy treat. Proceeds will go to the Animal Protection Society of Durham's work in educating the community about responsible pet care, spay, neuter, and pet adoption. The Bull City soon will have a new burger joint. Seth Gross, co-founder of the Wine Authority's wine shop in Durham, plans to open Bull City Burger and Brewery in February 2011, at 107 East Parrish Street within the Rogers Alley Project. It will serve lunch and dinner 7 days a week. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Frank Van Leeuwen, Chris Basden, and James Gallagher. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to: Board members signal change for RTP. This article is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. And along with the article, there's a aerial picture of RTP. The caption reads, RTP houses some 170 companies inside the park, including IBM. Research Triangle Park has been credited as being a major economic engine for much of the corporate investment and job growth in the Triangle over the past five decades. But will its business model work for the next 50 years? That is the critical question that the board of directors of the Research Triangle Foundation, the entity that owns and manages Research Triangle Park, will be mulling over the course of the next 12 months as it prepares to hire a national consulting group to develop a new master plan for RTP. It will be the first master plan developed for the park since it was formed in 1959, says Richard Doherty, a retired IBM site executive and chairman of the foundation board's Master Plan Task Force. Two national design firms have been shortlisted for the consulting work, sources close to the committee confirm. They are Air St. Gross of Baltimore and Cooper Robertson and Partners of New York City. Both have experience in the field. Air St. Gross helped develop a master plan for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Carolina North Campus that was approved in 2001. The firm also did campus plans for Duke University and Wake Forest University. Cooper Robertson helped develop a master plan for UNC Charlotte in 2001, as well as campus plans for Duke University's health system in 1993. The RTF board is expected to vote on its choice at its meeting on September 2. Doherty says board members are going into the process with no preconceived notions about what the outcome will look like. Anything is on the table in terms of running the park, he says. In May 2009, an Urban Land Institute panel, commissioned by the RTF board, came up with a list of recommendations about how the park's nearly 7,000 acres of land in Durham and Wake counties could be better utilized and how operations could be improved. Research Triangle Foundation staff would not release a copy of the ULI report, but RTF board secretary, Smedes York, says it included recommendations to improve traffic signage throughout the park's main roads, a project that is now underway, a list of properties that the board might consider acquiring in the future, and encouragement to create a new master plan for the park. Regarding the master plan, York says the board wants to make sure it has the tools it needs to continue growing in the future. We're certainly going to keep a lot of what we have, but there could be some residential elements introduced and reworking of land used with town centers, he says. You have a great pass by always looking at the future. RTP has long served as a model for the 140 research parks that have developed across North America over the past 35 years, and it is the only U.S. research park among the 10 largest research science parks in the world, according to the Association of University Research Parks. More than 170 companies occupy space in RTP, employing more than 42,000 workers. Companies there include stellar brands such as IBM, GlaxoSmithKline, RTI International, Cisco Systems, and Fidelity Investments. But the rules governing RTP are strict. All companies with operations within the park boundaries must be involved in design, research, and related operations that require a, quote, high degree of scientific input, unquote, according to the park's covenant. Its zoning laws also stipulate that no more than 15% to 30% of a company's land be covered with buildings, depending on which side of the Durham-Wake County line the land is located. The zoning laws have always encouraged expansive park-like settings for corporate tenants, but it discourages most types of dense development that many modern-day companies favor. The foundation has been sending warning signals over the past 5 years that it could be running out of land to sell. It has about 530 acres available for purchase in a park that comprises 6,971 acres. RTF board member Bob Winston, who is also chairman of the UNC Chapel Hill's Board of Trustees, says the master plan consultants will base their analysis on discussions with RTP tenants and employees and government and business leaders from throughout the region, as well as a review of RTP's growing competition worldwide. They'll be looking at all our preconceived notions, which may be right and might be wrong, Winston says. RTF President Rick Weddle declined to discuss the matter. Scrutiny begins for hedge funds. That's the headline on our next article. This one written by Lee Weisbecker. And underneath this article, there's a picture of Elaine Marshall standing outside of the Capitol building in downtown Raleigh. The caption reads, Elaine Marshall's office will regulate some hedge funds. While the full impact of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law is far from clear, one major change is obvious. Previously unregulated hedge funds now will undergo oversight. Large hedge funds, those with $100 million in assets or more, will be regulated by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, while those with less than $100 million in assets will be under the oversight of the states. In North Carolina, the task will fall under the watch of Secretary of State Elaine Marshall. Her department's Securities Division is charged with overseeing investment activities in the state. Officials in the division estimate the new law will add 100 additional investment advisory firms to the 335 it currently oversees. Exactly how many of those are hedge funds is difficult to say, says Secretary of State spokeswoman Liz Proctor. North Carolina registration requires the firms to disclose the states in which they do business, the staffers in charge of compliance issues, a rough gauge of the value of their investments, and any criminal and regulatory cases in which they've played a part. Not coming under state supervision, but reporting to the SEC for the first time in the firm's history, will be Durham-based Titan Capital. The derivatives trading firm, started in 2007 by John Burkert and Rex Golding, has more than $100 million under management. We don't see it as a big problem, says Burkert. One of the major issues in financial reform was to bring the unregulated parts of the derivatives industry, including the trading of credit default swaps, onto exchanges, offering greater transparency. The swaps, essentially insurance contracts offering protection against corporate default, were implicated in the meltdown of insurance giant AIG. The lion's share of trading at Titan has been swaps and other credit default obligations that already were exchange-traded and therefore transparent. We wanted to keep it simple, says Burkert, adding that the firm supports reform efforts to shift more derivatives trading onto exchanges and therefore out into the open. One group going through financial reform with a fine-tooth comb is the banking community. Supporters of Dodd-Frank spent a considerable amount of time trying to answer the questions of how much capital banks should hold against their loan portfolios and what makes up the best kinds of core capital. In answering the second part, they moved against one type of financial instrument, trust-preferred securities, a hybrid that acts partly like stock, partly like long-term debt, and that currently makes up $148 billion of the core capital at 1,400 bank holding companies, including Raleigh-based First Citizens, which has $265 million. The reformers have ordered large banks, those with more than $15 billion in total assets, to do away with them, and First Citizens, in a recent federal filing, outlined its plans to do so in three installments beginning in 2013. The bank didn't estimate the cost. UNC Charlotte finance professor Tony Plath believes the banks face two disposal options. They can sell additional shares of common stock to raise new capital, or they can use retained earnings to replace the trust preferreds. Both alternatives can be pricey, he says. For the larger banks, this is a huge deal, Plath says. In our next article in the Triangle Business Journal, it's on page 3. It's in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside the border, it's beige color, setting it off from the rest of the paper. At the top of the inside the box, there's a picture of a man leaning up against a moving truck, and the caption reads, "Moving on movers, Danny Wilson got the ball rolling on changes in regulations on moving companies." And then under that, there's the headline in the article. The headline, "Out of compliance, most moving companies not getting required checks." And this article was written by Frank Van Leeuwen with a Dateline of Raleigh. A big majority of the 275 moving companies operating in North Carolina are not in compliance with a state regulation that mandates company owners and board members to undergo an FBI criminal background check. North Carolina's regulations on companies that move household goods are among the most strict in the nation. They are under the supervision of the North Carolina Utilities Commission, which last year approved the rule regarding background checks. Two-thirds of moving companies operating in the state have not complied. Pam Stanley, executive director of the North Carolina Movers Association, expresses frustration with the rule. She says most movers want to comply with the law, but the commission has given no guidance or instructions on how to do so. She says companies have tried, but their attempts were rejected without explanation, and some companies say they won't comply. A lot of people don't want to be in the FBI database when they've done nothing wrong, Stanley says. The commission has ordered 187 moving companies that have failed to meet the new requirements to appear at an October 26 hearing. Companies that do not comply with state requirements face monetary fines and could risk losing certification to operate in the state. The rule changes were sparked by Danny Wilson, owner of Apex-based Movin' On Movers, who in 2007 asked the commission to toughen the requirements for movers after the commission had approved the application of a company whose owners were convicted felons. Wilson proposed that applications be required. Wilson proposed that applicants be required to have a valid North Carolina driver's license, that they show they have not been convicted of a felony for 10 years before the application, and that they be a U.S. citizen. Wilson says he intended the rule changes to apply to new applicants, but the commission ruled that the changes, including a requirement of an FBI background check, apply to all moving companies. Moving companies typically conduct background checks, which generally cost in the range of $35 to $50, on their own employees. National moving companies often require such checks for local affiliates. Of the 35 states that regulate movers, California, and Oregon are the only states that require an FBI background check of a company's owners, Stanley says. The requirement has proven difficult even for companies that want to comply. Owners and board members must go to their local law enforcement agency for the background check. Some police departments won't do it, and Stanley notes that some companies have owners and board members who live in other states, even if they do business in North Carolina. She favors an online background check. Bruce Ramakers, director of the Utilities Commission's Transportation Division, says he can't discuss which requirement companies are not meeting. He would only say that companies have not come into full compliance, but he acknowledges, as a controversial issue, the question of whether the requirements should apply to movers that have been certified by the commission, in addition to new companies seeking certification. Wilson says concerns about identity theft have him worried about background information once it is in the commission's hands. Stanley says she advised companies to black out Social Security numbers from the forms. Subsequently, she was told by some company owners that their applications were rejected because the Social Security numbers had been blacked out. The number of companies represented at the October hearing probably will be fewer than the 187 out of compliance. Some companies have resubmitted paperwork and have recently received the commission's blessing. Wilson is not among them. He says he and some other movers have asked for a meeting with Commission Chairman Edward Finley to discuss the matter in advance of the hearing. He's still waiting for a reply. And now we turn to the section in the Triangle Business Journal called A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. It's divided into three sections, the nonprofit news, the philanthropy news desk column, and a people on the move section. We'll start on the left side of the page with the nonprofit news that runs vertically up and down the page. Brookdale Senior Living, the parent company of Innovative Senior Care Home Health of Durham, has donated $100,000 to North Carolina Central University's College of Behavioral and Social Sciences. The donation is intended to fund paid internships for students interested in home health and elder care. Care of the elderly is increasingly important as the baby boom generation reaches retirement age, and the gift gives NCCU an opportunity to serve that population, said NCCU Chancellor Charlie Nelms. DHIC Incorporated has received a $10,000 grant from the RBC Bank to support the nonprofit organization's home buyer education and counseling efforts. Raleigh-based DHIC provides education and counseling to more than 200 first-time home buyers annually. GEICO has pledged $10,000 to the John Avery Boys and Girls Club Durham for its Project Learn program. The program helps educate children through interactive activities and positive reinforcement. This grant is an investment in the lives of our children, and it will pay dividends for many years, said Sheila Reiba, executive director of the John Avery Boys and Girls Club in Durham. And now the Philanthropy News Desk, written by Todd Cohen. And Todd Cohen is also the editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal. The headline, Nonprofit Aims to Get People Involved. And there's a picture along with the column of two people sitting in front of a poster. The caption reads, Henry Kaysner and Heather James co-founded Durham Cares. Nearly 2 years ago, two entrepreneurs who head Cary-based Bandwidth.com, one of the fastest-growing privately held companies in the U.S., commissioned a survey to test their sense that many people in Durham were not giving as much time and money to charity as they might, and to find out why. The survey of 450 households by Chapel Hill-based FGI Research found 64% of Durham's population had not volunteered for local charities the previous year, and only 1.6% of income had been given to religious groups or charities. But a large percentage of residents said they would be involved and give more if they could find opportunities to volunteer that matched their interests and if they understood their impact. As a result, Henry Kaysner and David Morkin of Bandwidth.com co-founded Durham Cares, a nonprofit that makes grants and matches volunteers with nonprofits. Durham Cares, which operates with an annual budget of roughly $150,000, has screened over 150 volunteers and made grants last year totaling $85,000 to 9 nonprofits. And this year, it will be helping to give at least $105,000 to nonprofits with funds it generated through a cross-country bicycling event in which it fielded a team of 8 local participants. Distribution of grant funding typically is based on performance goals the nonprofit set. Durham Cares also mirrored the National Race Across America event with a local race at the American Tobacco Campus that featured riders racing around the clock and generated pledges totaling 9,000 volunteer hours. Heather Jones, one of only 2 paid employees of Durham Cares, says its mission is inspired by the New Testament and the parable of the Good Samaritan, a story she says illustrates the importance of crossing racial and cultural boundaries and building relationships to help a neighbor. We love to see people crossing boundaries in our community, getting to know one another and serve one another, she says. Durham Care provides, quote, high-touch, unquote, consulting for individuals who want to get involved in the community, akin to a headhunting service, Jones says. Prospective volunteers take a 30-second online survey, followed by a 15-minute phone interview with a Durham Care's volunteer match specialist in which they are asked who they are, and what they like to do, what their passions and job skills are, and whether there are any deal breakers that would keep them from volunteering. The organization has developed relationships with roughly 60 nonprofit partners, asking them to identify their need for volunteers, with about 30 of those nonprofits now actively engaged with volunteers through Durham Cares. The organization, which asks volunteers to commit themselves to volunteering for at least 6 months, also follows up regularly with the volunteers and nonprofits to make sure the match is working. It also provides strategic consulting through Micro Consulting for North Carolina, or MC for NC, a nonprofit organized by local college students, as well as marketing support for its nonprofit partners. The goal of Durham Cares, Jones says, is to engage all Durham residents in crossing boundaries with both their time and money in ways that show relationships and ongoing commitment. And then our last section on this page is the People on the Move that runs along the vertically along the right side of the page. The Triangle, Eastern North Carolina chapter of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation named the following to its board of directors: Chuck Barnwalt, John Kroll, Melissa Essery, Amy Gardner, Steve Gilbert, Andrea Iverson, Oliver Johnson, Andrew Kreiman, Chris Letourneau, and Sue Sharon. The Wake County Community Foundation named Carrie Ludwig, Ruth Peebles, and Marty Clayton to its board of directors. Rachel Selisker, president of CMARC Advisors, was named chair of the Wake Tech Foundation's board of directors. Arnie Morris, director of wealth management, Coastal Carolinas at RSM McGladrey Incorporated, was named vice chair of the WTF board. Larry Hamilton, a partner at Hughes Pittman and Gupton LLP, was named treasurer of the Wake Tech Foundation's board. And in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal, there's also a special section, Women in Business 2010. And we're going to read a little bit of the first article that concerns the Lifetime Achievement winner, Nita Fulbright, of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. The headline on the article, Building Networks, Starting Programs to Bolster Chamber's Goal. And this was written by Brian Austin. Nita Fulbright wants you to join her network. In her 26 years at the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, Fulbright has seen the Raleigh area transform from a sleepy southern town to a burgeoning biotech-fueled metropolis, and she knows the power players who have shaped it. She's a kind lady who says she is looking forward to her retirement, but she is also a savvy social connector who sees potential in everyone. The thing we preach is build your core network, and that is a group of people that is out marketing you as well as you are marketing them, Fulbright says. And as the winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award from Triangle Business Journal, she's done well with that task. My core network is pretty big, she says. Fulbright began her run through the Social Network of North Carolina Business as another involved parent attending PTA meetings at the elementary school her three children attended, Francis Lacey. And after she was asked to put together a program for the countywide PTA, she eventually went to work for the Wake County Public School System. Her job was to build relationships with businesses in the Raleigh area to reintroduce them to the school system most hadn't seen since they graduated. She started the Wake County Educational Foundation to put more business people in touch with the Wake superintendent. Fulbright was recognized in 2008 by the Wake Education Partnership for the work that was critical to the success of Wake County Public Schools. From there, she found her way to the Raleigh Chamber, where she has been putting together events and connections since the mid-1980s. You really can't be in touch with the Raleigh Chamber and not know Nita Fulbright, said Rod Frankel, president of Frankel Staffing, a 16-year-old company that made the Raleigh Chamber its first business partner. Frankel said he found the connections and programs Fulbright put together to be invaluable to his then upstart business. Not knowing anyone before he moved to Raleigh, Frankel came to rely on the chamber and considers Fulbright a close friend. Nita is certainly a loyal, committed, and omnipresent force with the Chamber of Commerce, he said. I truly believe that Nita is one of the unique individuals in that she is not ego-motivated. She truly is pleased with the success of her organization, but she is most pleased with the success of the members of the organization. Fulbright is full of success stories of Raleigh businesses, both large and small. She got to know Jim Goodnight, CEO and co-founder of SAS Institute. She also pointed out Ron Smith of marketing firm S&A Cherokee, who has expanded his business ownership several times over since she met him. Hundreds more have passed through the chamber, and plenty of them recognize Fulbright as the person who first helped them establish connections. Some of these successful programs Fulbright helped launch include Raleigh SCORE, collaborations with Wake Technical Community College's business programs, and the Raleigh Business Expo. Though Fulbright said there are plenty in her quarter-century tenure that she has forgotten she even attempted. While being interviewed for her achievement award, Fulbright remained unfailingly humble and deferential. I haven't really wrapped my head around it yet because that's an award other people get, she said. Even as she plans her retirement in December, she has an eye on the chamber's future and another on her future volunteer opportunities. Her network intact, Fulbright will use her connections to give back more to her community. I can't go from working at the chamber to nothing, she says, adding that she started her career with volunteering. I look at it as just a different phase, she says. I had my world before chamber, my chamber world, and now I'm going into another phase. And we're going to stop there, as the article is quite long and goes into a question and answer section after that. But now for our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Aviat to shutter 190-job RTP facility. Aviat Networks, and that's spelled A-V-I-A-T, will close its Research Triangle Park operation, eliminating most of the 190 jobs there, the company said. The closure is part of a previously announced cost-cutting initiative designed to save Aviat between $30 million and $35 million a year. The company plans to shift work from the RTP facility to other locations and cut the Triangle jobs over the next 6 months. Aviat will keep a handful of sales and customer support employees here to service Triangle area customers, said company spokeswoman Cynthia Johnson. She could not say how many jobs would be spared. Inspire Shelves Dry Eye Drug. After a decade of development and disappointment, Inspire Pharmaceuticals finally has put a stop to its efforts to win U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval of a dry eye drug now called Prolacria. The Durham company on Wednesday unveiled a modified collaboration agreement with longtime partner Allergan that opens the way for Inspire to close the door on Prolacria and move its focus to pink eye treatment, Azacite, and the company's promising cystic fibrosis program. Inc. 500 features 10 from Triangle. You can count 10 Triangle companies among the 500 fastest-growing private concerns in the United States. A10 Clinical Solutions leads the Raleigh-Durham parade on this year's Inc. 500. The Cary Company, Cary-based clinical research organization, took the 92nd spot with a three-year growth rate of 2,714%. The 220-employee concern, led by CEO Leah Brown, grew its top line from $295,485 in 2006 to $8.3 million in 2009. A10 was one of 8 Wake County companies and one of 4 Cary concerns to make the Inc. 500. The other 2 Triangle companies on the list are based in Durham. To see the full list, go to www.triangle-businessjournal.com and search for Inc. INC period 500. Pocket Gear raises $15 million, looks to hire. Mobile application provider Pocket Gear Incorporated will grow by at least 25% over the next 2 quarters after closing on a $15 million second round of venture capital funding, the Durham-based company said. Trident Capital and the BlackBerry Partners Fund led the Series B round, which brings Pocket Gear's venture haul to $18.5 million in 2 rounds. John Moraine, senior managing director of Trident Capital, and Kevin Talbot, co-managing partner of the BlackBerry Partners Fund, will join Pocket Gear's board of directors. Pocket Gear will use the money to add more than 10 employees to its current staff of 40 over the next 2 quarters, said company spokesman Tim Horan. Delta to add 14 RDU flights, 5 new destinations. Delta Airlines announced plans to add new nonstop service between Raleigh-Durham International Airport and 5 cities this fall, while also increasing service to 3 existing destinations. The new destinations are Hartford, Connecticut, Columbus, Ohio, Orlando, Florida, St. Louis, and Tampa, Florida. The airline will also launch additional service to Boston, New York JFK, and Minneapolis, St. Paul. The new service will begin on November 1 and will add a total of 14 daily flights. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.